Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Trump impeachment inquiry concluded 72 hours of hearings on Thursday. The House Intelligence Committee wrapped with testimony from two witnesses who underscored the belief that President Donald Trump likely withheld military aid and a White House meeting to persuade Ukraine to investigate a political rival. The Democrat-controlled House has framed Trump's actions as bribery intended to benefit him personally. Republicans have insisted there was no such quid pro quo. The U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, on Wednesday addressed that GOP defense in his opening statement.
Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
We're talking about the impeachment hearings and more with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
And I think I start every week by saying, what a week.
Yeah, I know.
It's been some week.
Yeah, it's been a week. It's been a week. In fact, you know, besides the fact that President Trump was live tweeting during the testimony, I'm wondering if you could compare and contrast this one with Watergate hearings, knowing that you were barely born by then, and also the Clinton impeachment hearings.
Well, I was in my 70s during the Watergate hearings, but thank you very much. But I've thought about that a lot. I've thought about it from the beginning because I did watch those June 1973 hearings led by Sam Ervin, the Senate Watergate Committee, even before it went to the House. And I do remember John Dean talking about there was a cancer on the presidency. And I do remember Alexander Butterfield talking about that, yes, there were recordings taking place in the White House. And this was dramatic stuff. And this was June of 73. Mm-hmm. And Nixon didn't resign until 14 months later. So for all the people who were saying, well, where was the real drama in this time? Where was the real smoking gun with Donald Trump's impeachment inquiry? Well, look. I mean, the whole thing has become political. Democrats haven't changed their minds. Republicans haven't changed their minds. And while Nixon impeachment is a good way to go back, the fact is that Republicans didn't turn on Nixon until the last minute, until after the Supreme Court made the president release those tapes. Mm-hmm. The Watergate tapes should be public. Until then, there was no... there's no sense that Nixon was leaving anytime soon. And right now, there's no sense that Donald Trump is leaving anytime soon.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're kind of wrapping up the week in politics, lots to talk about. And thank goodness Ken Rudin could join us. He's a journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You know,
can I just want to say one thing?
Yeah.
In my podcast this week, we have Sherrod Brown, who announces on my show, he announces, I asked him point blank, are you running for president? And he said, yeah. No, he said no. But anyway, but he's on the show this week.
Sherrod Brown, that U.S. Senator from Ohio.
That's correct.
All right. So I was famously grounded that summer in 1973. So I actually watched the hearings. And but
wait a
I was
second. That's
obviously
a story.
You know, everyone at wants to know and I'll never tell. But okay. And my parents are both dead now, so I don't care. But you know, I'm trying to remember back. I did watch most of the hearings, and you know, but I was very young and obviously politically naive. And I'm trying to remember if there's the same kind of rancor in the hearing room as there has been over the 72 hours of testimony given in the House Intelligence Committee. Do you remember?
I don't think so.
It was different.
Yeah, I do remember. Look, the Republicans were still defending the president, although in 74, when the House Judiciary Committee began its impeachment hearings, there were Republicans who voted against him. What fascinates me about this thing is not only are the two parties so diametrically opposed to any kind of agreement or anything, but even those very few Republicans, like Will Hurd of Texas,
right,
like Elise Stefanik of New York, both of whom have been Trump critics in the past, neither one, and first of all, Stefanik has now become a vociferous Trump defender.
Mm-hmm.
Will Hurd, who the Democrats were saying, please, we need some Republican to vote for impeachment to make it look like it's more bipartisan. Will Hurd has made it clear that he sees nothing as an impeachable offense. So when all is said and done, this may be completely on a partisan, you know, by party basis, mm-hmm, the vote, which is going to probably come before Christmas, certainly before Christmas. I think it's going to go to the House Judiciary Committee after Thanksgiving. There may be a hearing or two, but basically the vote is going to come before Christmas. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's going to be Democrats voting yes, for the most part, and Republicans, if not all of them, voting no.
What about the timing of this? That sets it apart as well, doesn't it? 11 months before, you know, a referendum on the presidency?
Well, that's a good point, because if you think of the two impeachment cases in our lifetime, of course, I was only a kid with Andrew Johnson in 1868, but both Nixon and Bill Clinton, both of whom were in their second term, having been reelected by a landslide. Nixon won 49 states in 72. Right. Bill Clinton easily beat Bob Dole in 96. They were both in their second term, and there was no such thing as a presidential campaign interfering. And one of the arguments that the Republicans have been making is that what the Democrats are doing, what the crooked media are doing, is that they're trying to overturn the results of 2016 and let the voters have their say in 2020 and not make this part of a political circus, which is what the Republicans are claiming.
Is it a damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of a situation for the Democrats? I mean, you either have to go forward with this or not. And if you don't, what would have been the equation?
That is exactly what Nancy Pelosi has been wrestling with all this time. She was always hesitant about opening up this impeachment inquiry because she knew that, one, for the longest time, the American public was not on board, and two, Congress was split on it. But I think the feeling is, and it's not because of pressure from the left wing of the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, but Pelosi says, look, whether Trump is convicted in the Senate or not, and to be honest, nobody thinks that 20 Republicans are going to vote to convict Donald Trump in the Senate, let alone maybe two or three. I mean, there may not be any, for all we know. But the fact is that to stay silent in the wake of what they see are impeachable crimes, and that's exactly why Nancy Pelosi went from quid pro quo to bribery, which is an impeachable offense. The fact is the Democrats were not going to stay silent. They were going to say, look, it may not end with the removal of Donald Trump, but for us to stay silent, for us to do nothing regarding impeachment would be a dereliction of our duty.
You know, one of the things that Congressman Hurd from Texas has made the point of saying, though, even though he says he won't support impeachment, he doesn't see an impeachable offense, is he does look at the bungling, what he sees as bungling diplomatic policy in Ukraine. And in his opening statement, Gordon Sondland, the European Union ambassador, in his opening statement on Wednesday, said that he didn't consider the behaviors in question problematic at the time and that no one appeared concerned. Let's hear what he says.
Precisely because we did not think that we were engaging in improper behavior, we made every effort to ensure that the relevant decision makers at the National Security Council and the State Department knew the important details of our efforts. The suggestion that we were engaged in some irregular or rogue diplomacy is absolutely false.
It's almost as if it was kind of happening in plain sight, in his opinion at least. And
exactly,
I'm just wondering about the optics of that alone.
Well, exactly. When William Taylor, I think it was William Taylor, who later became the chief diplomatic presence in Ukraine, who said that there were two channels working foreign policy. There was the official channel, and there was this rogue channel led by Rudy Giuliani and others who were trying to force the Zelensky government in Ukraine to open up this bogus investigation into the Bidens as a political favor for the president. But exactly, Sondland said, look, it was in the open. Everybody knew about it. And by mentioning the vice president and the secretary of state and the acting chief of staff, in addition to the energy secretary, Rick Perry, I mean, Sondland said that everybody knew of it. So for all the defenders of the president who said, well, you know, there really wasn't much there, and this was just Rudy Giuliani being Rudy Giuliani, Gordon Sondland put an end to that belief.
Today, President Trump repeated the debunked claim that Ukraine is connected to a hacked Democratic server for the 2016 election. That's the same assertion he raised on his call with the Ukrainian president at kind of at the heart of this inquiry. And Fiona Hill, she is the former top Russian specialist on the National Security Council, was one of the people who testified yesterday. She repeatedly disputed that claim. Does the president's actions when he is tweeting these things help or hurt his supporters going forward?
Well, that's a great question. And I was thinking of that a few days ago when Marie Yovanovitch, the former Ukraine ambassador, testified. And in the middle of it, while all the Republicans are saying, thank you for your service, thank you for your service, you did a great job, Trump is tweeting that you are a disaster, Marie Yovanovitch. You were a disaster when you were in Somalia. Look how that worked out, as if Marie Yovanovitch was responsible for what happened in Somalia. And then she said that he said the same thing about her stewardship in Ukraine. So I've always thought that, you know, there are so many unforced errors that the president has made in this case. And of course, there are so many people who are supportive of him or not who say, look, just be quiet and let the Elise Stefanik's and the Jim Jordans and the others do your defense for you, but don't make things more complicated by intruding on with some crazy tweets. And that's the look. Nobody is going to stop the president from being Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He'll be like that throughout the case, throughout a Senate trial, and throughout the election in 2020. But one might think if anyone was giving advice to Donald Trump, and I don't think anybody can because Donald Trump doesn't seem to listen to anybody, the things he does, the tweets he makes, it just seems like it's so counterproductive for him.
And, you know, speaking of tweets, I think Sondland had the last word when he said easy come, easy go, because while he was testifying, the president was tweeting that he didn't even know the guy, barely knew him. Kind of, you know, whatever he said, and it and was, hilarious.
The president was outside the Rose Garden or whatever, in front of a helicopter, probably. Remember, they would always criticize Reagan for having press conference outside the helicopter. But he said, I hardly knew the guy. Yeah. I mean, matter of fact, he was for another candidate. Everything's about Donald Trump. He said, he wasn't really one of my supporters. He came on late. Of course, he gave, I think, $1 million plus to his inaugural campaign. And, you know, he obviously, Gordon Sondland felt that the president knew him more than the president admitted. But again, if you say nice things about the president, you're his best friend. If you say things critical or disputing what the president has said, I have no idea who this guy is, and he's a never-Trumper and a rogue agent. And sometimes he'll call them human scum, which again, one would think is beneath the language of the president of the United States, but I guess it's not.
We are talking politics. We're talking about the Trump impeachment inquiry going on. Well, it looks like the testimony has concluded at this point, and they're going to be whipping up a report and sending that to another committee, a judiciary committee in the House, which writes up the articles of impeachment. Could be, as my guest Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, pointed out, they probably will vote on those articles before Christmas. We will continue our conversation about that, but there's also the Democratic presidential primary debate. There's also some presidential pardons of people convicted or facing trial on war crimes. Lots to talk about. So if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Trump impeachment inquiry and other national politics today. Still with us, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, political journalist Ken Rudin. Will post a link to that podcast at WOSU.org/allsides. Regarding the, you've mentioned a few people who have attracted the attention of the public when it comes to these hearings. I'm wondering what fortunes are being made on either side of the aisle on the committee.
Well, if you're asking who stands out, is that what you're asking, who stood out for the committee?
I guess, at this point, in a good way.
Well, it depends on your point of view, of course. I mean, somebody who likes, and there are people who love what Elisa Stefanik is doing. There are people who love what Adam Schiff is doing, and there are people who can't stand either of them. So you know, praise is in the eye of the beholder, of course. But having said that, Nancy Pelosi, I thought, made a very smart move in taking this away from the House Judiciary Committee. Remember, if you think of previous impeachments with Nixon, it was the House Judiciary Committee and Peter Rodino. For the Clinton impeachment, it was the House Judiciary Committee and Henry Hyde, the Republican from Illinois. But she decided to have this in the Intelligence Committee because whatever you think of Jerry Nadler, and this is not a knock on Jerry Nadler, Adam Schiff has a very quick mind. He's very self-assured, and he puts things very succinctly. So I think if you're a Democrat, if you like what you've seen so far from the Democratic hearings, Adam Schiff deserves most of the credit. There are other Democrats that have stood out as well. Jim Himes of Connecticut has done a good job. But on the Republican side, I think you have to say that Elise Stefanik is one of the big surprises for me because, one, first of all, until Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was elected in 2018, she was the youngest woman in the history of Congress ever elected to Congress. She had been a Trump critic on some things, basically on some things he's done, on tweets, on policy. But the fact that she's become a loyal soldier in this battle to protect Donald Trump, led by Devin Nunes and Jim Jordan, things like that, Stefanik has gotten some raves from Republicans as well.
Shirt-sleeved Jim Jordan of Ohio stood out, as always. Here he is questioning Gordon Sondland.
When the chairman asked you about the security assistance dollars, you said there needed to be a public announcement from Zelensky. So I'm asking you a simple question. When did that happen?
Never did.
They got
the...
I love when you ask a question and know the answer. You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like that's typical. But he, you know, it's like you love him or hate him. I mean, I will say he enunciates very clearly. You can always hear him.
And he has good handwriting, so I think that's very important.
But what about that? He also irritates people no end. Does it matter?
He does. And remember, I mean, it's not only Democrats who are irritated by him. Remember when he ran for Republican leader in the House against Kevin McCarthy, he got clobbered. It was like, you know, it wasn't even close. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who feel he has gone too far. There are a lot of people who feel that he's out of control. And when he was leading the forces against John Boehner and then Paul Ryan, two previous Republican speakers of the House, they just felt he was more of an irritant. But at the same time, those who are watching these hearings like what they see with Jim Jordan, the fact that he has done everything he can to make this, you know, in Trump's words, a witch hunt and a fabrication. And, of course, with his, I mean, I think last time I was on the show was during a fundraising show. If we can raise money and buy him a sport jacket, I would feel so much more comfortable. I don't think public radio money should go to it, but if people want to call him.
It could be a side raise.
But I think he fits the role perfectly. I mean, of course, he has his own problems and his questions about the Ohio OSU scandal that he says he knows nothing about. And of course, if you take a look on social media, you'll always see Jim Jordan be referred to as Jim, G-Y-M Jordan, which of course is knocking him as well. But again, he's the kind of guy who, like Newt Gingrich, in a sense, you either love him or hate him. And I think after watching all these hours of testimony, I think people feel both ways.
Let's see. Dave and Hilliard, you wanted to talk about Jim Jordan. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, Ken kind of commented on the appropriateness of his behavior. But as a follow-up, guys like Jim Jordan be stained sometime in the future when Trump is gone in, you know, 2 years or 6 years, I mean, I feel like some of these guys are never going to get the stench off of them for supporting Trump now.
What do you think, Ken?
Well, I don't know if it matters. And I like Dave's question a lot because there are a lot of, I've seen a lot of reference to the, you know, to the Republicans who have been sticking with Trump and avoiding the truth, and judgment will eventually come. I don't know if that's the case, because I think that unlike with Nixon, when the whole country turned against him for the most part, and many Republicans were defeated for defending him in the 1974 midterm elections, I don't see any, as I said, I don't know if any minds in Washington have been changed. I don't know if any minds around the country have been changed. So even though I've been watching Fiona Hill and Gordon Sondland and Alexander Vindman, whom Republicans questioned his patriotism and his loyalty, which is, to me, beyond belief, I don't know if there's a price to pay, given the fact that the way the lines have been drawn in congressional seats,
yeah.
You know, the Jim Jordans of the world will get reelected for the most part because, one, their constituents like it, and two, their district lines support him.
Super safe district. All you have to do is look at it. But Dave and Hilliard, thanks a lot for your call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the politics of the day with Ken Rudin, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Francis in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Francis.
Hi, I have a rhetorical question.
Okay.
If a person is kidnapped and a ransom is demanded, but before the ransom is paid or before the person is injured, they get away, is that still a crime?
And
it's not rhetorical. I love this question. This is exactly the Republican defense. They said, well, the president didn't withhold the aid. Well, the reason he didn't hold it, he eventually gave Ukraine the military assistance it needed. After the fact, after he was caught, after we found out about all these things. So just because as Francis says, just because the kidnapping failed, and you can make the case just because the thing that the Trump and Giuliani and all those guys were trying to do with Ukraine failed or were discovered, that doesn't mean it didn't happen. But that is the Republican defense. Look, it didn't happen. They got the money, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
They're also trying to equate
a meeting, I think it's in Geneva, with between the president and the president of Ukraine. A meeting there, they've equated that with a meeting in the White House. There's a big difference, isn't there, diplomatically?
Exactly, which is what Zelensky was angling for from the beginning. Look, mm-hmm. This is a country that was he was just elected in 2019. Russia is at his doorstep. They've occupied and annexed Crimea. There are Ukrainian soldiers killing. I'm sorry, there are Russian soldiers killing Ukrainians every day. And he turned to the United States as one of his top allies and said, we need this aid. And given the fact that what we know about Donald Trump and his appreciation, shall we say, for Vladimir Putin, there's no way that Donald Trump is going to try to help an enemy of Russia. So basically, he has made things so difficult for Zelensky, but at the same time, embarrassed the career diplomats in the United States for using political bribery, in the words of Nancy Pelosi, to coerce Zelensky to do something that would benefit Donald Trump politically. It's wow. I mean,
it's very different.
I don't think I'm just wondering if the report from the Intelligence Committee to the Judiciary Committee, all it says is the word wow. I mean, I'm just wondering if you need any more than that.
Francis, thanks a lot for that call. There is news that Senate Republicans have been meeting quietly, or some people have used the word secretly, with White House staff to plan the Senate portion of this process. So there's the articles of impeachment that'll be voted on in the Judiciary Committee, and then the full House, and then it'll be sent to the Senate for the impeachment trial. They've said that they want to limit the trial to 2 weeks and that kind of a thing. What about that? What about Senate members of the Senate or Senate staff working with the White House to plan this?
Well, obviously, given the fact that the assumption, the conventional wisdom, is that the House will vote to impeach, if the White House were not meeting with Senate aides, that would be very surprising to me. I thought it was very interesting yesterday, as Fiona Hill was testifying, Donald Trump was having for lunch at the White House Mitt Romney and Susan Collins, two Trump critics, two obvious jurors, if it ever goes to the Senate,
yeah,
and two Republicans who have basically, if any Republican is going to vote for conviction, and I'm not convinced anyone will, let alone the 20 that they need, but it's Romney and Collins who are most being watched and watched most closely. And it's interesting that yesterday that President Trump had those two jurors, or should I say senators, mm-hmm, to lunch with him.
Hmm. Let's see, Eugene in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, and so I was wondering, obviously, with how things are going, sometimes what people truly feel, and I assume same with the lawmakers, what they truly feel, they cannot express it because they're afraid, obviously, of being voted out or the president coming after them. Is it not possible? Why can't the voting be done in secret? Essentially, why can't it be a secret ballot? And also, I read this morning Nikki Haley essentially saying everybody knows that the Trump wanted the investigation, but the monies were released. So it seems like they keep shifting the goalposts. But I think the main question I have is, why can't this voting be in secret?
And he brings up, we just lost him, but I think it's interesting that he brings that up because we keep hearing repeatedly, there's no rules. They're making this up as they go along. So do you know why, Ken?
Well, I think what Eugene is asking is, why can't members of Congress vote, have their vote secret,
right,
so they won't be subject to retribution by the voters? But look, that's what democracy is all about.
Right.
You get elected to office because you have to take positions. You can't hide behind anonymous votes. I think you have to be gutsy. And there are people who there are some Republicans who were gutsy enough, like Mark Sanford in South Carolina, who made his displeasure with Trump known, and he paid for it in mm-hmm. the Republican primary. But for the most part, a lot of these people go to Congress not so they can make a statement and get defeated. They want to continue their career, and they know that if you stand up to Trump, if you criticize him, one, you'll be savaged by the president on social media, and two, Republicans in your home district will mount an opponent, mount the primary opponent for your next time. I was just thinking, 6 years ago, at this time, mm-hmm. in South Carolina, Lindsey Graham was considered a maverick Republican. He was very critical of Trump. He was a pal of John McCain. And there were numerous county committees in South Carolina that voted to censure Lindsey Graham because he was not conservative enough. He mm-hmm. was too much of a maverick, and he was leaving the party.
I was just listening to an interview he did. It was like a car interview inside of a car. He was driving or something.
Or a car accident.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But he was talking about Joe Biden. This was years ago, and he was talking about Joe Biden. I think it was after Joe Biden's son, Bo, had died from cancer. And he was lauding him. I mean, it was just lavishing Joe Biden with praise. Are you there? Ken Rudin? Okay, I thought, wow, Ken's awful quiet right now. We'll get Ken Rudin back. In the meantime, we'll just go ahead and take a quick break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is really, truly Ken Rudin, a journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Our guest is Ken Rudin, journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about national politics today. We've just finished up on the impeachment for the time being, the impeachment inquiry, I should say. I wanted to talk about the president's decision to reverse, first of all, granting clemency for three members of the military, who two of whom have been convicted of war crimes. Another one was facing a trial on war crimes. What about the presidential pardons? How do they play with the military and people who identify with the military, Ken Rudin?
Well, pardons are always a controversial thing and a risky thing. But basically, when you pardon two members of the military, convicted of war crimes, there was an outrage from the military, from the brass, that said, wait a second, you don't do this. This is beyond this. I mean, who benefits from this? It's just such a pointless thing. I know maybe because of what they did, that may satisfy, may make some conservatives pleased or something. But the military was livid when he came out with these things of clemency.
He reversed the Navy's decision to oust a Navy SEAL chief petty officer who had been granted clemency. He went even further and immediately reversed that.
Yeah, if his strongest base, or a part of his strongest base, is the military and the conservative military establishment, to basically spit in their eye and just do the opposite of what they prefer, it's just, I don't know.
It's unclear.
It doesn't make sense to me. How does he benefit politically? How does the rule of law benefit at all? But
it is certainly legal for him to do it. He has said, I think it was this morning, it might have been yesterday, said that Mike Pence will remain on the ticket.
Well, you know, that is a parlor game that we play every 4 years. Mm-hmm. People forget this, but there was a lot of talk prior to 2012 that Barack Obama was going to drop Joe Biden and pick Hillary Clinton. And I think it was Bob Woodward of the Washington Post who said, I heard from inside sources this was going to happen. I mean, we hear this. We heard it when Nixon was going to drop Agnew, Ford, you know, everybody was going to drop everybody. And of course, it hasn't happened in a ticket since Franklin Roosevelt dropped Henry Wallace in 1940 and picked some guy named Harry Truman. In 1944, you should say, picked Harry Truman. I don't know what ever happened to him. And it's fair to say that Gerald Ford did dump Nelson Rockefeller from his ticket in 1976 because of outrage from conservatives. He picked Bob Dole. But for the most part, it's a game. It's like a brokered convention. Wow, we're not going to know who the nominee is until we get to the convention, and there'll be a brokered convention. That doesn't happen anymore, and neither does dumping a vice president, especially somebody who is loyal as Mike Pence is. But having said that, the latest rumor, of course, was one of the reasons Nikki Haley wrote this book that basically says that Donald Trump is right and everybody else is wrong, which is not the Nikki Haley of the past.
Right.
It's because she wants to push Pence off the ticket. I don't see that happening.
Let's see. Karen in Youngstown, you're on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Ann.
Go ahead.
I'm calling because I have a question. It is not impeachment related,
okay,
but it's Trump related.
Well, everything.
How come the news media is not giving what I would like to see as much coverage about the fact Donald Trump had to pay back $2 million in the state of New York for embezzling it from a charity, his own charity? And I guess now, consequently, he can never have a charity again in his name in the state of New York.
I guess the same question could be asked for why haven't we talked about the Democratic presidential debate yet? I mean, Ken Rudin, to Karen's point.
Well, I blame Ann Fisher for the lack of the
debate. We're going to get to it.
Okay, but Karen makes an interesting point. Basically, this was $2 million that was allotted to veterans groups that the president promised and used for his own campaign, his own personal use, his campaign, I should say. And this is What, I mean, it's like the Trump University. You know, there was an out-of-court settlement, and people forget about it. That's what's so amazing about Trump, because whenever there's a controversy and we say, oh, my goodness, he'll never survive this, there's something else to talk about 5 minutes later and people forget about it. But Karen makes a good point. We should not forget about it. This was just egregious, the fact that he took $2 million promised to veterans, another group that loved that, you know, that supports him, and used it for his own purposes. And that's just, it's just despicable. But like everything else, he pays a fine or he pays the money back, and there we go. We're back again. And now it's time to talk about the debates.
The debates. Let's see, where are my notes on that? they were not unlike the previous debates. I mean, there was not a lot of surprise in them. But what is your overall impression? Who, winners, losers?
Well, see, I love the debates because there seems to be a different dynamic every time. Remember in the first debate, it was Kamala Harris talking to Joe Biden about segregation and school busing, and suddenly she became the conversation of the week. And then it was Elizabeth Warren talking about, you know, her plans and everything. She was zooming to the top of the polls, and then everybody couldn't stop talking about Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. Now it's Pete Buttigieg who's jumped to the top of the polls in Iowa,
right,
which is less than 3 months away. I'm a little February 3rd, which actually is closer to 2 months away. But can Pete Buttigieg win? I mean, the fact is that he has minimal African-American support. Right. And how can you win the nomination if you're not getting any black voters behind you? Having said that, and then say, like, well, look, Joe Biden is still the national front runner, and he has a big lead among African-American voters and a big lead in South Carolina. But one thing, there is not a national primary. The fact that Joe Biden is leading nationally, look, he was the loyal vice president to Barack Obama. People have great respect for him and even love for him. But what happens in Iowa and then New Hampshire, I think, is much more crucial. And subsequent states, whatever the polls are now, could very well change if they see some kind of momentum building. The thing about Pete Buttigieg, of course, is that you don't win the nomination, the Democratic nomination, without black support. Mm-hmm. And Bernie Sanders learned that in 2016. The African-American voters stuck with Hillary Clinton from the outset. And basically, if anything, they were largely responsible for the fact that she beat Bernie Sanders for the nomination.
What do you make of Buttigieg's assertion or point that he made during the debate, not equating, but comparing or contrasting his experience as a gay male with that of the African-American community?
Well, that's a tough sell, but sure. I understand. Look, the fact that the gay and lesbian community in this country has been marginalized and criticized and brutalized in many cases, mm-hmm. and I think he saw that I sympathize or I feel I identify with the black struggle because I've struggled as well. There are people like Cory Booker say, well, you know, I don't know if it's exactly the same. And Cory Booker has talked about everything that's just destroying the black and brown communities in the country. And I don't think comparing to Pete Buttigieg is the right answer. But somehow this guy with, you know, who was elected mayor of South Bend with 11,000 votes, as Andrea Mitchell pointed out, this guy is somehow wooing a lot of voters. Not somehow, because he has a great story to tell.
Yes.
He's an Army veteran.
He's very eloquent.
I've never seen him do a bad debate performance as well. And, you know, somebody who I have a great respect for and thought she was doing really well all along, Amy Klobuchar, she seemed unbelievably nervous on Wednesday, almost the fact that she was shaking. I kept watching her hair move because her head was shaking. And I don't know if it was nerves or whatever, but sometimes when that happens,
she's intense.
Oh, she is intense, and she happens to be a delightful person. But this time, she seemed, you know, for her to say, well, I passed more bills in the Senate, you know, than any other person, that may be the case. But what's changing? I mean, what's changing? So I don't know what the answer is anymore. I don't know if it's Joe Biden with his 400 years of experience. I don't know if it's Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who feel that corporate America has destroyed the country and the party, and it's time to move to the left. I don't think any Democrat knows, and that's why you have people like Deval Patrick and maybe Michael Bloomberg getting in the race, because they feel, well, if Pete Buttigieg could do well, and if Kamala Harris could do well, well, so can I. But ultimately, it's going to be not the polls that decide things, not the pundits, but it will be starting with Iowa on February 3rd. And, for better or worse, that's where the nominee is going to come out of.
Amy Klobuchar became the first Democrat to file for the Ohio primary, notably. She is holding, but not showing a lot of momentum, as you said. She still has a great line, though, when talking about women's prospects to make the debate stage with a resume as thin as Buttigieg's. She said that she did the classic women have to work harder, blah, 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 to get the same amount of credit. Let's listen.
We have to work harder, and that's a fact. But I want to dispel one thing, because for so long, why has this been happening? I don't think you have to be the tallest person on this stage to be president. I don't think you have to be the skinniest person. I don't think you have the loudest voice on the stage. I don't think that means that you will be the one that should be president. I think what matters is if you're smart, if you're competent, and if you get things done. I am the one that has passed over 100 bills as the lead Democrat in that gridlock of Washington in Congress on this stage.
So making that point.
If you let that bite go a little longer, I think she had one of the best lines of the night.
I agree.
She said, anybody who disagrees, who thinks that women can't do the job, just think how the fact
a woman
that
who can't
Pelosi
go up against Trump thinks a woman can't.
Right,
can't
exactly.
Trump.
Nancy Pelosi defeats him every day. So
right.
She has good lines, and she's a very likable candidate. And again, for those who feel that the Democratic Party is moving too far to the left, and there are those who are nervous about that in their hopes of beating Trump in 2020, she seems like a good candidate. But I think with the rise of Buttigieg and other so-called centrists and the fact that it's just, hard to break through. And but plus the fact that you talked about her filing for the Ohio primary, which I think is March 3rd, right, on Stupid Tuesday. But the fact is, her coming from Minnesota, if she doesn't win in Iowa, she's not going to win in New Hampshire or South Carolina or Nevada. I think she has to win or to come in top three in Iowa for her to survive. And look, again, I hate when pundits say, well, here's what has to happen. Look, let the voters decide. But she has a tall order, and Iowa is crucial for her.
The Associated Press wrote that exchange between Buttigieg and Kamala Harris about the importance of the black vote. About LGBTQ issues or the experience of being a gay man versus that of an African American. Highlighted the importance of the black vote in the nomination process. And the Associated Press wrote that exchange also exposes what they called an uneasy relationship in the party civil rights coalition as it increasingly recognizes LGBTQ rights as a priority. What about that? I mean, we're talking about you're saying that the African-American vote is critical to the Democratic nomination. They're also kind of pulling together the coalition of that with suburban white women. What about that? What about that uneasy relationship?
Well, there is an uneasy relationship between the African-American community and the gay community. That's been significant for a long time and known for a long time. Another thing that cannot be discounted is the fact that in June in South Bend, Indiana, there was a black male who was shot dead by a white cop in South Bend. Buttigieg did not handle that to the best of many people thought he should. He has not hired that as many African-American police officers as people said he should. So, yes, he had a very emphatic and emotional response to what it's like to suffer discrimination as a gay man. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I'm here on a stage wearing a wedding ring is a great success. But there are things closer to home that he's going to have to deal with, because, again, he is just like Elizabeth Warren was at one point and as Kamala Harris was at one point. He is the rising star of the Democratic Party, both with polls, both with fundraising. And and again, he's going to have to convince this very large constituency As Cory Booker said, look, we don't need a focus group to realize how important the African-American vote is. I mean, Cory Booker, as far as he knows, he's been a black voter for, since he's 18 years old. You know, he made some jokes about that. But the fact is, there is tension between the black and gay community, and it could affect people to judge, or he could win them over. But he's, we have some time to go, but not that much time. But then again, if not him, who? That's the thing. If not him, who? Every time I watch Joe Biden, yes, there's a lot of sympathy for him. The fact that the whole Trump administration and Giuliani and everybody else is doing what they can to discredit him and his son. And you think he would go into a debate and pound his chest and say, I'm the guy they want to defeat. But then he says things like, I have the support of every African-American woman elected to the Senate, when Kamala Harris is sitting right next to him. And she said, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Or he'll say these things then he'll talk about the violence against women and how abhorrent there is violence against women. And then he urged everybody in the next breath, keep punching.
Right.
How do you not hear that?
It's the Biden gaffe problem.
Exactly.
It's in the right place, people say, but yeah.
We saw that in 2008. We saw that in 1987, the two times he ran for president before. And it's even worse now because you could say, well, it's age. Well, Bernie Sanders is older. I mean, Joe Biden is 77. Bernie Sanders is 78. You'd never know Bernie Sanders had a heart attack or was old because he is always solid with debate performances. Mm-hmm. And yet never have I said that about Joe Biden.
One issue, we only have a few more minutes left, but it kind of brings together in that same AP article that I read, there was a reference to Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. And it recalled for me a recent interview with an official Atlanta. It could have been Mayor Lance Bottoms, but was before the debate, saying that the Democrats no longer should shy away from the South. You wrote recently before the off-year elections that three Southern states that went overwhelmingly for Trump in 2016 were the highlights on that election day, Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. What about the South? Is there a tide turning there?
I don't think so. I really don't. And I'll tell you why. Because, first of all, one of the reasons the Republican governor lost in Kentucky was not because of Trump and not because of ideology, because he was a very, very unpopular and contentious kind of guy. And as it is, he only lost by 5,000 votes at about 1.4 million. So he barely lost, and everybody else on the ticket were Republicans, and they won big.
Right.
The election in Louisiana was much closer than people thought, even though the Democrat won, the Democratic incumbent won. And I thought the Republican candidate was not especially impressive. Trump went in there and made it close. So, yes, Virginia was a big, big win for the Democrats. But again, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, whatever you think about what happened in 2019 in the elections, there is no question those states will be solid red in 2020. It's maybe states like Georgia, if they allow the African-Americans to vote, and Texas, where there are demographic changes happening. I don't know how soon they're happening, but those are the states to watch. But ultimately, again, as I said to Sherrod Brown on my show, I said, I thought Hillary Clinton should have gone to him, John Kerry should have gone to Gephardt. Mm-hmm. The Midwest is where the election is going to be won or lost. Democrats can't forget that.
Well, Ken Rudin, went too fast this time. I look forward to talking to you next month and looking ahead to those primaries and a lot of other, who knows what we'll be looking at, right?
Yeah, we may not have much to talk about.
Ken Rudin, esteemed journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.